Have you registered for the Recruitment Coach Live Summit yet? Here's reason number three why this will be the best investment you make in your business in 2025. You'll discover the latest trends. Listen, the recruitment industry is literally changing before our very eyes. What worked 2 years ago or even last year could already be outdated information. If you want to stay current in terms of the technology, the adoption of AI and automation, and the tactics and strategies that are actually working right now in today's marketplace, then you need to get yourself to London on September 17th or 18th. Do not get left behind. Register now at recruitmentcoach.com/summit. Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Whitby, and my very special guest today is Matt Schwartz. Matt is the president at MJS Search. He's a top producing recruiter. He's been running his own firm for 17 years now. Prior to that, he's with Heidrick & Struggles. Matt and I have been working together for a few months, and I begged him to come on the show and share the story of how he's built his successful search practice, serving Fortune 500 companies in New York City, one of the most competitive markets in the world. Welcome, Matt. Thank you so much for doing this.
Hey, Mark. Thanks for having me.
So can we start with you telling the story about your recent health issue? Because I think that's very relevant to what's happening right now. In particular, you know, I know that you recently closed a deal while you were literally in your sick bed. Could you tell that story, please?
Absolutely. So I recently came down with coronavirus. It was probably one of the strangest illnesses I've ever had in my entire life. I came down with it officially on March 18th. So fairly early on, although the government and doctors were warning, you know, for a week or two before that we should all be a little bit more careful. I was being careful, but was going in and out of New York City the week before and probably, you know, got it through my travels. You know, for anyone that is in denial or maybe doesn't know anybody that's been infected by coronavirus, it's very real. I'm based in Westchester County, New York, where it's somewhat of an epicenter. And we've had tens of thousands of cases and unfortunately about 1,000 deaths just within our county, not just, you know, New York State as a whole. For me, it was, cold-like symptoms, a little sore throat, stuffy nose. Then I started to get horrendous headaches, fever. My fever never got that high, no higher than 101.6, which typically wouldn't sideline someone all that much, which I felt okay. But then symptoms kept happening even 7, 8, 9 days in, whether it was the, you know, prolonged fever, loss of taste and smell, and then the breathing issues started. And fortunately, I was able to get an inhaler, just a basic albuterol inhaler that, you know, calmed my coughing. And I was able to ride it out from there until the fever ended. And I got out of quarantine 14 days later. I was in full lockdown in my bedroom, didn't see my family for days at a time. I've been, you know, doing okay ever since. But not fun. I know a number of people who have had it. Everybody has experienced it slightly differently. And some have been almost asymptomatic, but actually have after effects in terms of health issues that are affecting them. And these are all young, you know, healthy people. So be careful. So Mark, to your point, yes, I closed a search in the middle of my coronavirus. About a week in, we were making an offer to a very senior candidate who's responsible for something called Unified Customer Profile at a large global financial services company. Significant comp in the high six figures. someone who is, you know, really going to make a massive difference within this organization. We checked references. I did a reference while I was sick. My associate did the other couple references. We got to the point where we made the offer in conjunction with the client. And luckily, there wasn't a lot of back and forth on the negotiation. And we were able to close the search smoothly during this whole thing. Couple things to think about, though, is that this candidate is based out west, needs to relocate east. Obviously, well, not obviously, but, you know, my client being a phenomenal employer needed to be very cognizant of the fact that, one, this person needed to move and think about moving in the middle of a pandemic. They needed to really express their sensitivity and really show a lot of flexibility in regard to how are they going to onboard this person. Are they going to be able to allow them to start this really big, important job remotely? How are they going to think about relocation just a little bit differently? And in this case, this person's spouse needed assistance as well, moving their job after many, many years with that employer. So lots of things to think about beyond just making a placement and completing the search. Especially in this crazy time. And I think showing the sensitivity and the flexibility was really number one.
Wow. So Matt, setting the issues surrounding the placement to one side for a second, and just addressing the health side of it, like that sounds super scary. What was going through your mind? What were you feeling during the, you know, when you were feeling really miserable?
Yeah. Two things. I'll get to how I was feeling in a second. But one, it was frustrating a lot of days because I would feel pretty much okay. I wasn't talking a lot, so I wasn't coughing a lot. It was when I was talking that the cough would start. The thing that was most nagging was the fever. The fever would be gone the majority of the day and then spike at about 6 o'clock, you know, 6 to 7 o'clock at night. So I'd be like, oh, I'm doing great. I'm fever free. And then all of a sudden the fever would come back. I even went 2 days where I was fever free and then it came back again.
Oh.
And so super frustrating. The other thing was with all of these people, especially in the New York area, going to the hospital on ventilators, I did not want to go that route, but you really have zero control over it. I made sure I did not read the news and I did not watch anything. I did a little bit of 60 Minutes, which their stories have been all coronavirus related for the last, you know, month or two. But I don't know how, I think I maybe watched one episode during the time that I was sick. So I really tried to stay away from it as much as possible and not think about, you know, what was happening to, you know, my business and millions of other businesses around the country and around the world. And I think that that calm of really ignoring everything allowed me to focus on getting better and not be panicked. I get that question a lot. People are like, were you ever in fear that you were going to go to the hospital? And luckily, no. When I saw that the breathing issues were getting more severe, I got the inhaler and it made a massive, massive difference in terms of the inflammation. So that was great. I mean, you could barely, I took Tylenol even sparingly because I wanted the fever to break on its own and just, you know, pass through me, but, you know, didn't do much at all. So.
Wow. I mean, it sounds super scary and I'm so thankful that you didn't have to go to the hospital. I think that what would scare me is the possibility of being separated from the people you love, right? Most when
one of my best friends from college, they have a dear friend where they live in New Jersey who got sick about the same time as me, same age. And he was on the phone with his doctor, he and his wife, every single day. And on like, I think it was like the third or fourth day, the wife was like, listen, he's getting really, really bad. Took him to the hospital. They pulled him out of the car, and she didn't see him for over a month after that. Luckily, he lived and got out of the hospital and is now in a rehab facility. But you know, not being able to be near your loved ones. I mean, I saw my family out the window in the backyard a couple days, but there were days. I think I went 3 or 4 days without seeing my daughter at all. You know, she would text me, you know, from her room, you know, but it was so strange to be in the same house and not see anyone, for days and days and days.
Wow. I mean, and how did you stay sane? Cause it sounds almost like, you know, you're in prison in many ways, like you're in prison and in your room. Yeah. What did you, I mean, I know you weren't watching the news because you didn't want that negative input, but what else did you do to just occupy time and not go crazy?
I saw so many shows and so many series that I can't even remember half of them. I slept a lot, but yeah. The challenge with sleeping a lot during the day is my sleep at night was horrendous. So right. I tried to balance it out. And when I felt good enough, I would just, you know, walk around a little bit in my room and, you know, I tried to shower every day and, you know, just have some semblance of normalcy while I felt, you know, halfway decent. You know, I've had illnesses that, you know, like just the flu or, you know, strep or something where it was a lot worse. I mean, much higher fevers, you know, high 102s, 103, you know, that is awful. I mean, you're like delirious when you feel like that. But again, you get on antibiotics and within a couple of days you feel fine, you know, and this was not the case. It was just, you know, going and just getting weirder and more severe as time went on. So, you know, a lot of TV. I don't ask me for any recommendations. It's just too much. All right. Although I did enjoy Schitt's Creek. I saw all 5 seasons of that.
Gosh. So, and I know like you probably don't watch a lot of TV normally because you're a super fit guy. Your exercise regimen is unreal. Maybe we'll talk about that later. Yeah. So coming back to the fee then, I mean, you had to do, you know, I mean, you have to take care of business in spite of, you know, you being ill. Are you comfortable sharing how much the fee was worth?
$185,000.
Wow. Okay. So that was pretty important to get that completed.
Yeah. Well, we're a retained search firm. With our clients in this case, the full fee was billed within 120 days. And this search took a little bit longer based on the complexity and the limited number of people that really fit the role. So yeah, it was a big one. So typically I wouldn't mention the amount of the fee, but I didn't mention the client name, so I don't, or the candidate, yeah. So I don't have a problem with it.
Okay, terrific. Actually, could you just briefly explain the sorts of roles you fill and the industries you serve?
Yeah. So I started my career 25 years ago as a marketing recruiter, marketing and sales. Was with a boutique firm that was at the time the premier organization in the promotional marketing industry. There were a lot of what they call promotion agencies. They did everything from contests and sweepstakes and giveaways to sampling opportunities, et cetera. So it was, that was what we did early, what I did early on. And, I quickly adapted to be they called me the king of the Fortune 6000. So any company that you had never heard of that had a highly conceptual role, where you really had to tell the client's story and get people excited about it. That's what I got involved in. So it could be everything from bus wrap advertising to movie theater marketing and promotional experiences to in-store sampling and event activity. I even did a head of sponsorship for the marketing and licensing arm of the bowling industry. And then on top of that, at the time, we did a lot of transitioning of classically trained packaged goods executives to non-traditional businesses. So Procter & Gamble to banking or automotive and PepsiCo and General Mills and, you know, companies like that to, again, non-traditional businesses. So we did a lot of that kind of work. In 99, got recruited to Heidrick, where I was a principal in the global consumer practice. And because I had worked with a functionally focused firm, I was able to work in all areas of the consumer practice, from consumer packaged goods, media, entertainment and sports, retail, fashion, and luxury goods, and then advertising, marketing, communications, and marketing services activity. And that was a phenomenal experience, because I was a bit of a utility player and could keep myself very busy, especially because I was there from 99 to the end of 2002, which was a huge dip in the industry, and over 1,000 people were laid off at Heidrick alone. And some of my friends that were massive billers at other firms couldn't get any work at all. So very, very fortunate there. And then at the end of 02, decided to start my own firm. At the time, the world had just blown up, as we know. It was a huge meltdown, the first dot-com boom. And all of these companies that built these brands, epic brands, you know, just disappeared overnight. You know, they spent all their money on brand advertising and sock puppets and all sorts of stuff. Those companies all disappeared. The ones that survived were really focused on what we were calling at the time, and I guess it's still called, you know, measurable marketing. Now it's a no-brainer. All marketing should be measurable. But that was my stake in the ground to kind of position the company to be relevant. You know, anybody could say they do marketing work, but you know, the whole measurable marketing activity and showing a deep understanding of direct and database marketing was really key, and a little bit of email back then as well. The problem was I had no clients. I had relationships, but I had no clients. It wasn't like I was taking clients from Heidrick and bringing them over. I thought some opportunities were going to be gifted to me that were the crumbs for them, you know, below $85,000 fee. And I was more than happy to take them. But unfortunately, that didn't happen immediately. Later on, I ended up getting lots of referrals from them, but didn't happen immediately. So I really had to go and build one logo at a time, and figure out what my story and positioning is, which is really to get to your overall question. So what I did is I literally just built it, you know, again, one logo at a time, one search at a time, and let those searches tell the story. I had to stick to what I knew, which was a lot of this measurable marketing activity. But once we got inside of clients, they would ask us, hey, have you ever done something like this or something like that? And we would build up a much larger roster of searches to be able to continue on with the story. So the launching point was really PepsiCo. They were our largest client for 8 years. We started out doing a lot of traditional corporate communications work, some marketing work, innovation, category management, that sort of thing. But then in 2008, they said, hey, this social media thing is becoming real. You've done some of these other unique searches for us. Could you help us find a head of global social media? At the time, companies didn't have heads of social media. I mean, it didn't really exist. And even they knew that social media was going to become a part of everybody's role within the company, wasn't clearly a marketing function. It was a customer service function. It was a employee communications function. It was advertising and promotion was the lowest on the list, because no one wants to be sold to through social media. You know, they want to have a conversation with their customers and really let them help shape the brand and drive it forward. So we did that search. And then that led to the head of global digital marketing strategy. From there, they came to us and said, okay, we want you to fill a series of roles that have never existed before. And we don't even know if this person exists out there in the marketplace. And what it was they had just bought back their bottlers and inherited vending, fountain, and cooler equipment. So they said, hey, we're not in the vending machine business. We're in the marketing business. What if we could take this equipment, again, vending machines, coolers in convenience stores, and fountain equipment that you would find at like a quick serve or quick serve restaurant, and turn it into what we want to call retail-tainment. So let's take a vending machine and turn it into a giant touchscreen with facial recognition, the ability to play a video game or sing karaoke with Beyonce before you buy your drink, pay with your smartphone while having it all connected to the internet so you can collect data to optimize manufacturing, supply chain, and maintenance capabilities. So find us engineers with MBAs who have created game-changing products or services that have never existed before that can come in and reinvent our vending, fountain, and cooler equipment. So find us basically someone from a technology company that's willing to come to a packaged goods company and make a measurable difference for the future.
Wow, that's a tall order.
Tall order. So the first person we ended up placing was one of the creators of Xbox Kinect from Microsoft. So wow. He basically created, you know, and that was the person is the, you know, the controller, you know, through their movement. And ultimately, I believe they put Xbox-like sensors into the vending machines, you know, so they could identify, was it a man, a woman, a child interacting with the machine, and how is that going to dictate what kind of communication is going on in front of them in terms of this interactive experience. The second person was someone who came from the Microsoft Ford Sync relationship, where it was when people were first talking to their cars back about 9-10 years ago. So again, you know, another really interesting person. And then we also placed the head of big data for the whole project. How are they going to build the data stack and figure out what data they were going to collect, how they were going to collect it, but more importantly, how are they going to disseminate that data across the enterprise to make real-time business decisions to really optimize things moving forward. So at that point, manufacturing knows exactly what to produce based on the volume levels that are coming out of this equipment. Delivery drivers know exactly what to load up on their carts based on what equipment is in that particular building and what's selling greater to make sure that there's limited out of stock and they can maximize sales volume. So wow. We took that story of the Pepsi equipment and we're able to use that to showcase, hey, listen, we are great at identifying people from alternative industries who are the best of the best of what they do and bringing this mix of skills to diverse organizations, whether it's financial services, insurance, aerospace and defense, B2B manufacturing, and that's what we've done. So over the last 17, almost 18 years, we've built up a diverse client list from PepsiCo, American Express, Honeywell, DirecTV, Fidelity, New York Life, MasterCard, Equinox Fitness Clubs, just to name a few, as well as a number of smaller, more entrepreneurial businesses, often private equity and venture-backed.
Wow, that's cool. So Matt, I totally get how once you've done a successful search for a business, they're, you know, thrilled with the people that you were able to find for them on very difficult searches. I see how that would lead then to like repeat business and other opportunities. But I guess my big question is, how does a very small boutique firm when executive search retained executive search business from Fortune 500 companies, when presumably you're pitching against either an incumbent or against other suppliers who are perhaps like the sort of top 10 headhunting firms in the world, you know, the names that everyone's familiar with, and you're MJS, right? So how are you able to, first of all, get in the door in the first place, and secondly, convince them that they should take a chance on you instead of go with, you know, a firm they've already heard of?
Yeah. So, so typically we are up against one other firm, and typically it's a large one. So our clients that we have master agreements with, they will off. Yeah, they'll bring in a big firm and a small firm and let the hiring manager make the decision. We are fortunate that, you know, one, I was trained. I got a significant amount of training at Heidrick. So I'm able to say, hey, listen, you're getting Heidrick quality work from a boutique. We're not any cheaper. So we're really not any cheaper. So that's not really what the benefit they're getting. They're getting, at the end of the day, it's up to them to have a comfort in terms of who they feel most comfortable with. So I, you know, again, I can't speak negatively about any specific people within, you know, my competitors, but at the end of the day, I like to call it removing the black box. You know, we're all going to walk in there. We're going to be in our nicest suits. We're going to look good. We can speak in full sentences, but you know, what is it about our presentation that's going to get them to feel comfortable? I don't treat a sales conversation as a sales conversation. I treat it as a consultative meeting. I come in prepared with great questions, but not great questions like I'm picking up the search right at this moment or assuming anything, but really getting into their head and getting a deeper understanding of what's most important. I try and, you know, we get the spec ahead of time. I try and pull out the top 3 to 6 key criteria. I try and understand, you know, what are the types of organizations they'd like to see this person come from. But more importantly, I try and come prepared with a handful of potential profiles that would give the client comfort level that we understand the search and really, you know what's going on. So maybe I walk in the room with 10 profiles, but by being a great listener and really paying attention and being insightful, I may show them 2 out of the 10. And, you know, once they get a sense, and again, that's not the only thing, but once they get a sense of, wow, these guys really get it and get a comfort level there, and we can, you know, talk about other, you know, potential similar situations, or more importantly, have a calling card of a number of senior level game-changing placements within their organization, they basically say, hey, you know our organization, you know our culture, you clearly have a good grasp of the functional experience we're looking for. You know, we win more than we lose. So I think it's a little bit of confidence, but also, you know, experience within that company. I mean, with a few of our clients, we're to the point where they call us with opportunities and they know how difficult they may be. They know how difficult the hiring manager may be, and actually give us a choice if we even want to audition for the search, and, you know, have that meeting because they want to make sure we can protect our longstanding, you know, reputation within those organizations. And that's, you know, we appreciate that so much. That's how much partnership we have with some of our best clients.
Wow, that is great. If I can follow up on a couple of things you mentioned, which caught my attention. One was you mentioned hiring managers, and I just wondered to what extent you get access to hiring managers as opposed to you're kind of dealing with talent acquisition or HR, and how you navigate that. Because one of the challenges that I'm hearing from my clients with when dealing with large companies, in fact, some of my clients have stopped going after big clients, and they're focusing on smaller ones where they can still deal directly with the C-level, the decision makers, because they're finding that there's more and more layers, buffers between them and the client that they have to navigate, which can be quite a frustrating experience. And how have you dealt with that?
Yeah. So most of our large global clients have an intermediary in between, and that's a talent acquisition or talent management leader internally. They are the ones that are responsible for bringing in the firms that they think could be the best fit for this potential client, and then they make the decision together. So, and I'm okay with that. But with that said, the client, the hiring manager, is very involved. I mean, we have weekly calls. We go through the status of the searches. We really talk about candidates. And one thing I have to say about my talent acquisition partners, many of them are unbelievable recruiters in their own right. I mean, they are really, really strong and great at what they do. But when it comes to some of these more technical roles, they just say, you know what? It's not in my wheelhouse, so I need to hire a search firm to manage. And two, sometimes we have to reach out to 400 to 600 candidates to find, you know, 4 to 6 qualified and interest. 4 to 6 qualified and interested people for the role. And when they've got 20, 30, you know, requisitions on their desk, they just don't have the bandwidth to be able to focus, even if they could do the search themselves. So, that's where they really need us to be able to dive deep, to spend a lot of time way beyond what they would have internally. Otherwise, these searches would go on forever. These are searches that are in high demand, low supply, and the people are very sophisticated, and you don't get that many chances to attract them to these opportunities.
Interesting. So it sounds like you actually have a very healthy relationship with your talent acquisition partners. How do you negotiate that relationship to ensure that, I mean, it sounds like sometimes they're actually bringing you into the company, introducing you to the hiring manager, then the hiring manager decides, do we want to work with Matt Schwartz or whatever? So that's positive. Yep. But do you find you have to negotiate the sort of rules of engagement and insist that, you know, you have these hiring manager meetings? Because sometimes I find that internal recruiters want to be the point of contact and the conduit of information in both directions.
No, not at this level.
Okay.
The level we're working at, these are very, there may be L-2, they call it, you know, the senior most person within the firm. I mean, they may be two people away, people we're hiring, you know, yes. So it's, they have to be involved. If they're not involved, they're not transactional roles at the end of the day. Right. Yeah. So there's so many nuances in terms of not just the skill set, the technical expertise, but also the leadership qualities, that the only way to really experience it is one, to have an intermediary that you trust to be able to evaluate that. And then two, that hiring manager needs to be highly engaged, because they're getting, you know, daily or weekly calls from the president or CEO saying, hey, this role needs to get filled. You know, what's the status? And they need to be actively involved in that process. So again, I don't need to ask for weekly calls. The only thing I need to do is just manage their expectations on when those weekly calls can start officially. And typically, you know, week one is hardcore reach out, research and reach out. Week two, continue research, reach out, but we start interviewing in that week two. And by week three, we're presenting real qualified and interested candidates. I mean, we're not presenting the ultimate shortlist or anything, but we're well on our way and are hungry to make that call. Within those first 2 weeks, though, doesn't mean we go dark from the client. Often questions come up. We need to tweak certain things. We want to clarify certain things that maybe didn't come out or a question maybe we didn't anticipate. And the client's great. You know, they want to hear from us. We let them know they're going to hear from us. Most of the time, it's just a quick email, just getting a response from them. But, you know, they need, in a retained search relationship, we're billing the first third up front, you know, the second third after 30 days. So say they paid us a large chunk of money, and then 30 days later, we're ready to invoice them again, and they haven't seen the kind of activity that meets their expectations. That's not a great place to be in. Luckily, it's right. known across me and my team that we're going to meet those deadlines. And when that 30th day comes, there's no questions asked, that, you know, they know we're on it. You know, we've got lots of activity. We're already showing some good promise, and no questions about paying that second invoice when they're ready to pay it.
Matt, I get how once you're in front of the decision makers, be it the, you know, head of talent acquisition or the senior hiring authority, you know, you're going to be able to impress them. You can tell them the stories of the brands you worked with, the searches you've completed, you know, and how you've got a very creative approach to dealing with difficult searches, which, you know, and the people you're placing are in marketing roles where they make a measurable difference. I guess my question is, how do you get your foot in the door in the first place? Because, you know, with a firm, they've never heard of MJS, and you know, like, I'm thinking back now, you have kind of a great portfolio of clients, but thinking back to when you first started out, like, how did you go about developing your new business?
Yeah. It was a lot of referrals, mm-hmm. clients that, well, firstly, it started with, some people that I used to work with that went from search firm to in-house. And they were able to make some strategic introductions to get us great. Into like Pepsi, for example. So that was that. Then our Pepsi client went to another company and took us along. Our Pepsi client went to Pitney Bowes, and then another Pitney Bowes client went to MasterCard, and another search firm that specialized in a whole different function than us referred us to one of her talent leaders that she had a relationship with. And that person went from New York Life to Fidelity to Marsh McLennan Companies. I mean, it's just incredible, you know, that, you know, all this movement would spur, you know, new relationships. So, you know, between other recruiters in different functions and talent management people moving from one company to another, that's definitely been our best source of leads over the years. You know, the part that I've struggled with and some of the things that you and I have worked with is just the general marketing aspect. You know, cold calling doesn't work. People are excited to hear the MJS story when they hear it, but got to get in front of them first. And so that's a challenge. So I like to say good work gets good work. And between clients moving companies and candidates moving companies, you know, that's usually where the referrals come from.
Awesome. That makes total sense. Well, look, Matt, thank you so much for sharing your stories and your, you know, your expertise, your journey with us. Can I ask one final question? And that is, sure. Looking back over, you know, your 25-year career, what do you wish you knew then that you know now? Like, if you could go back in time when you're first starting your business, you know, what's been one learning that you've taken away from that?
Let's see here.
let me maybe I ask the question in a convoluted way. I guess the simplest way to ask the question is, what has been the biggest mistake that you have made that you turned out to be a great learning opportunity?
Yeah. Going after volume over quality.
Mm.
Volume for volume's sake was not great. The second I dug my heels in, focused on higher level, higher quality searches, things just changed dramatically. So would not that I wouldn't like to do 20 plus searches a year, but I would rather do 20 searches a year at a higher fee level than a lower fee level, because the work is the same, if not greater, at some of these lower fee level searches. Not to mention the ability to the team capability of what it took to execute a lot more of this work and higher volume work ended up really hurting the overall profitability of the company. So fewer searches at a higher level was definitely the thing that changed the business and took us into a whole nother realm. So now it took me years to get my first six-figure fee. And now it seems like, now it doesn't seem like, a majority of them are, well over six figures. And that's phenomenal. So leaving that behind and feeling, having the confidence that we could continue to move up market and be able to showcase that work has really been a massive game changer for us.
I'm so glad I asked you that last question, because that was phenomenal. And I agree 100%. It's really fascinating how the lower level roles take as much, effort and sometimes more, but for less reward. But what I'm interested in is that pivot point where you made that shift and where you decided, actually, do you know what? I'm not going to accept business below this amount. Weren't you afraid, like, well, what if it doesn't work and I've just turned down opportunities? What gave you the confidence to aim higher with the level?
So first of all, if someone's starting a search firm or are trying to get a hold of what we're talking about in terms of, hey, but I need the work, I need the work, I need the work type of thing, you got to start somewhere, right? You got to start and have a minimum in which you're going to, kind of draw the line in the sand. So for some people, it could be $35,000 fees. For others, it's 50. For me, it's 75. And, that's really, that's worked for us, right? So, being able to have that confidence and know that that's what you're going to focus on is really key. And, once you're able to do that, one, mentally, you're going to, get there. But second of all, you'd be surprised how many clients will say, what? We want to work with you. We'll pay, 50, if we have, we'll pay 50. We get it, So you can actually get people to maybe pay you more than what you're used to if you, are confident and can, really focus on that number.
Awesome. All right, Matt. Well, listen, thank you so much for your time today. I'm thrilled and grateful that you're healthy again. And so thanks so much. And for our listeners, thanks for tuning in. If you like this episode, then please give us a review in Google Podcasts Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And the best way you can support this show, if you want me to continue putting this stuff out there for the benefit of our industry, then please do subscribe. And that way you'll get every new episode directly to your phone each week. So thanks for tuning in. Matt, until we meet again, have a great rest of your day.
Thank you, Mark.